to the blockchain.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Henry Rain Show here on WWPR 1490 AM. Heard every Monday at 5.05 p.m. And normally I'm saying it's the second half of the financial power block here on Monday afternoons following Talking Markets. Well, I am following Talking Markets. But today, it's not the weekly roundup of Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, blockchain news, and more. No, this week we're going to take a break from Bitcoin and all the cable news sensationalism, the tribal politics of the news services, and we're going to try and bring some solid COVID-19, a.k.a. coronavirus, information. And, well, before we get to how we're going to do that, let me just say quickly there's a few things that have developed that I haven't really seen talked too much about on the cable news. I've heard a lot about whose fault it is and who's doing a great job, who's doing a lousy job, why somebody has a better plan. What's actually happened in the last 24 hours or so? Well, it isn't exactly the last 24 hours. It would be the last business day, Friday of last week. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, approved the first coronavirus test that can be conducted entirely at a point of care for a patient and deliver results in 45 minutes. And why is that important? Well, besides just the fact of getting the result, knowing if you have a coronavirus, we're going to tell you why the whole scheme of testing that we've been using has been problematic. You may have heard that on the news, but we're going to go a little bit more deep into it and alternative ways of dealing with that. In fact, an alternative is at-home diagnostic startup Scanwell, which produces smartphone-based testing for UTIs. Testing for UTIs with this, don't worry, guys, is working on getting at-home testing for the novel coronavirus into the hands of U.S. residents. That, though, is waiting for FDA approval, but has been used quite a bit in China. The Justice Department has quietly asked. Now, this one, I need to slow it down just a little bit because I'm taking you off the crisis, and there's a saying, never let a good crisis go to waste. So let me say this slowly. The Justice Department has quietly asked Congress for the ability to ask chief judges to detain people indefinitely without trial during emergencies, part of a push for new powers that come as the novel coronavirus spreads throughout the United States. That one got me a little upset. That's why I stumble over a two-syllable word like novel. Anyway, how are we going to deal with this? Because I certainly am not the person to give you the authoritative information as much as I might pretend to say it with authority. Well, we're going to talk to a retired respiratory therapist and a former ER nurse, two different people. And the former ER nurse is also a healthcare educator. We're going to sort through all these facts. So let me pull up the volume on our phone lines. I will let both people know that now that I've hit the audio channel here, both of you are on the same channel. Anything one of you says will not only be heard by the other person, it goes right out over the airwaves. So let me start out by first welcoming, for the very first time ever on the Henry Rain Show that I can remember, certainly as a guest, Rick Lewis. He's a retired respiratory therapist with over 30 years of experience, and actually, I think my experience with him probably goes back, 56, 57 years from grammar school. But you find the experts where you can find them. Rick, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Henry. Good to have you here.
Yeah, well, let me also introduce our other guests and try the volume up just a little bit more now that I've heard Rick. Well, this Dave might think he's familiar to the audience, and he was familiar with the audience. If you're around part of the audience, I guess it was 15 years ago, because back 15 years ago, 16 years ago, there was a morning show called American AM on this radio station, and I was the host, and the very first co-host of American AM was Sarasota Dave. But not only was he the very first co-host, he has a Bachelor's of Science in Nursing, 20 years clinical nursing, including ER and trauma, currently involved in healthcare education, And I'm sure they don't call him Sarasota Dave there, but we do. Hey, Dave, how you doing?
Good to be back, Henry. I can't believe it's been that long.
Yes, you're old. It's amazing
it's
you survived.
Just like yesterday, we were sitting looking over the Manitou River on our first show.
Yeah, and then a little bit later we moved over here, and it's just as sanitary, and I feel just as safe from the coronavirus here as I did 15, 16 years ago. All right, let's get right into this, and we've got a couple things to fill out, and we're going to get to that right away.
I tell you, I've got news for you.
So it was late Friday night that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the first coronavirus test that can be conducted entirely at the point of care for a patient and deliver results in 45 minutes. Cepheid's Expert Express SARS-CoV-2 is a rapid molecular diagnostic test for qualitative detection of the SARS-CoV-2, blah, 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 virus causing COVID-19. The company said in a press release, the test has been designed to operate on any of the more than 23,000 automated gene expert systems worldwide. Now, Rick, I want to get to what it's like to be a respiratory therapist, but I do want to take just a moment with Dave right here because to enlighten about the testing. Because, Dave, testing has really been the weakest link around the world. It's also been some of the strongest performance in other parts of the world, but it's our weak link right now here in the U.S. without pointing fingers. We just haven't tested enough. And why is that important?
Because that's what, you know, keeps it from spreading. I mean, if you know who's infected, you can act, you know, well, not, I want to say proactively because they already have it, but you can be, you know, much more, quicker in a reaction, you know, as you said. Hell, South Korea is producing 100,000 kits a day. They don't even need them. They're starting to ship them to other countries. They were on top of this pretty quick. I mean, they were a little slow out of the chute initial, but that's been a key part of their response to already, as the experts call it, flattening the curve. We have failed miserably in the testing.
Right. And South Korea, I believe, a few days ago at least, I don't know what the current number is, had tested 300,000 people. They had not put in the restrictive measures to the level we have, and in fact they've opened up society a little more because they have a handle on the size of the problem. Let me go back to Rick, because now let's talk about just the respiratory therapist that's at the hospital, either perhaps you get called to the ER, perhaps you're, the patient's already been admitted and you're dealing with them. But putting aside coronavirus, what kind of problems did you see in your 30 years as a respiratory therapist?
Well, we always had staffing issues, you know, and just like nursing and everything else, you know, it's hard to get people and hard to get good people. And, but besides that, you know, you're in contact with people, and especially in the ER, that you don't know, you know, what they have when they come in. You know, you're just, it's just somebody being admitted into the ER, and you're supposed to be there. And so it's a lot of times you don't know that you've been exposed to something, whether it be this or TB or something else, until hours or a day later.
And
that's always been an issue.
Before we were worried about this problem, you could have been exposed to it, but did you... You know, we hear how we need PPE, personal, what's
personal
PPE?
Personal protection.
Equipment?
Equipment, yeah.
Yeah.
PPE,
so
yeah.
When you were seeing these other people back in the normal course of your work, what kind of PPE did they give you?
Oh, well, we had gowns, depending on the hospital. You know, some of them were paper, some of them were like a plastic, and then there were some back in the day that were actually a cotton or something. But then you'd have different masks for different situations. You'd have the regular, what they call, say, a surgical mask that you would wear if it was a certain level of isolation, you know, whether it was contact or if it was airborne. You know, you had different masks for different things. So if it was an airborne thing like TB possibly or any other airborne, you had a heavier duty mask that had a lot more filtration than just these surgical masks.
Did you ever feel like you were short of equipment regarding the threat you were being presented with?
Back then, no, not really. I mean, we always seemed to have enough. You know, it was a matter of sometimes not having it on the floor, but then you could call and get it. You know, it wasn't a real big big deal back then.
So when you hear about news stories today when they're, you know, they're the whole state may have a two-week supply left and they're waiting for a million to be delivered, or a million kits to be delivered or something like that, did you ever think, did that anything like that ever cross your mind, I guess I'm asking?
Not really. I mean, you know, it seemed like, you know, we seemed to always have our, you know, the things we needed back then, because we didn't have anything at this, you know, to this magnitude, really, that I can remember. You know, it was, you would have, you know, some possible TBs, or then you'd have the C. diff type stuff, but it was never to this degree.
Okay. And I don't want to have too much of your time, so I want to I'll keep it moving for you. And then you worked in a number of hospitals, and if Dave has anything to add to this next question, please do. And, you know, so there was a certain number of ICU beds in each hospital that was, you know, when it was constructed and or expanded, you know, they put those in. And for normal situations, normal flow of patients, I know you were in a lot of different hospitals, same with Dave, but what would be the range of beds for the ICU section?
Well, some were, you know, anywhere from 8 to 12, but then there were, like at Bayfront, they had several different ICUs, and each one had, I think, probably about 8 or 9, maybe 10 beds in each one. So they had 4 in one wing that were all ICU, and then you had another on the other side with the neuro ICU that was another 11 beds. But what would happen if you know, in situations like this, what they're using are the recovery rooms or the PACUs, the post-anesthesia care units, because they're essentially another ICU-type area. So they can use those as overflow now, and the ER, some of the ER places.
Okay, and because that almost all the hospitals have stopped elective surgery, you know, you're not going to get your knee arthroscopy or, you know, something like that done, but you still have the trauma that might come in for another reason, an auto accident or something like that.
Yeah,
but
certainly.
For the most part, they're cutting out the normal flow of patients that would be using those beds. So let's just say, just for a number, let's say 3/4 of whatever was available is available without having to kick somebody to the curb. That's probably the wrong phrase to use.
Right.
Dave, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I mean, it's similar to what Rick said. You know, I've worked in some very large medical centers in Atlanta, and they might have 30 or 40 total in, you know, critical beds. I mean, but they'd be ICU or cardiac, you know, beds, CCUs, or even neurocritical units, you know, specific to trauma and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's a very, very similar situation. I've never seen a situation where I felt like equipment was at short supply. And the only time I ever saw anything short supply was blood during a mass shooting up in Atlanta. I mean, we almost ran out of blood one time, but
okay.
Nah, I mean, this is
all right.
This is new territory right here.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
So back to Rick. Now, in the course of your 30 years, but especially like in the last 10 to 15, you know, it seems like every 3 or 4 years there was something that, you know, it was going to be the next, I don't know if they'd use the word pandemic, but the next serious medical threat, whether it's swine flu or bird flu or SARS. And were you periodically from your management at the hospitals briefed on, you know, these upcoming threats and what to expect?
Yes. Well, I mean, they usually kept us updated on that kind of stuff. But, you know, even looking back on those days, we never felt, you know, overwhelmed or that we were getting into that pandemic situation.
So let's, and I'm sorry to rush you, but even though we got 40 minutes left, I can see how much information there is to give the audience. So in all these other heavy flu seasons or named flu that were, you know, people were talking and worried about, what was the heaviest kind of situations you would have to deal with in that course as a respiratory therapist?
Oh, mainly, you know, it was your basic, you know, flu-like symptoms and stuff. So we'd give them breathing treatments and, you know, manage them that way. But, you know, you always have those high-risk people, you know, whether they're cancer patients or lung patients or cardiac patients. You're always going to have those people in any of this situation. So, you know, you take care, you know, you always just took care of what you could, and then, of course, there was always going to be a few that ended up on ventilators or something and, you know, took it to the next level as far as...
What was the most that you would ever have on ventilators at the height of flu season at one time?
Oh, geez. It's hard to say because, you know, our flu season kind of ran into tourist season at the same time. So, you know, you could have, you know, at Bayfront, for instance, from all the units, we've 30, 40 ventilators going.
Okay, but not all of those would be for flu, right?
Not all of them. No,
okay. You know, what about you, Dave?
Well, you know, I mean, Rick can speak to the ventilators a hell of a lot better than me. We used to call the respiratory therapists, you know, the cavalry, because there's only so much a nurse can do, you know, from a breathing standpoint. We can bag them and, you know, give them oxygen, whatever. But so, you know, I look to those guys as sort of heroes, you know, come in and save the day, you know, when somebody went into respiratory distress or even failure. We would put people on ventilators in the ER, okay, but they were out of our hands.
So, taking it quickly.
The goal was to get them in ICU immediately.
Yeah, taking it into what we're dealing with now, or what the medical profession is dealing with now. So, as I understand it, we're filling out the ICUs with people with acute respiratory distress syndrome. Rick, what is that?
Well, it's kind of a cause of the long-term ventilation. You know, you're using pressure to ventilate people's lungs that's constant. You know, you've got more pressure than you would normally take in your normal breath. And so eventually, long term, it will cause barotrauma, which is the capillaries and stuff in the alveoli will start leaking into the lungs. And so the lungs will start filling up with fluid. And it's like a pink frothy fluid. And you'll notice that all of a sudden your patient's, you know, has all these secretions, and so you know they're going into pulmonary edema, which is part of ARDS or ARDS is what we call it. And so in respiratory, you know, you have to, and in all these situations, it's not just the lungs we're worried about. You've got the kidneys and the heart all involved too, so you can't really mess with one of those other systems without making something happen to the others, is what I'm trying to say. So, you know, being on a vent's just not the answer, you know, because then you have to deal with the kidneys and the heart. And when you have overload, fluid overload, like in ARDS, then the kidneys are going to be affected and the heart because it has to pump harder against that extra fluid.
Okay.
So it's a whole big circle.
So the people come in and they can't breathe without the ventilator.
Right.
And then the longer they stay on the ventilator that is keeping them alive, it's actually causing deterioration of their breathing capacity, correct?
It can, yes, over time.
I mean,
you know, especially
there's two other problems associated with being on the ventilator, and that's becoming vent dependent, and also VAP, which is ventilator acquired pneumonia,
right.
Because you're more susceptible to other bacteria coming in.
Okay. And so when we see something like at the people on ventilators in Italy, there's now a 50% mortality rate, which has got to be pretty scary whether you're the patient or the family once that bridge is crossed. It was just a few days ago I saw an article that said they were not ventilating people that were 80 and over, and then just today I saw where the new level, because they had a huge number of deaths in the past 24 hours and a huge jump in cases, is 60. So
yeah.
What does that say to you as a respiratory therapist, Rick?
Well, it's scary. You know, it's like death panels or something. You know, it's you're going to make it and you're not, and we can help you, but we can't help you. That's pretty scary. and there's no respiratory therapist or nurse or doctor that wants to get into that situation in the United States. They, you know, we're expected to fix everybody. And so I would hate to see it come to that point. And, you know, another group of people that we kind of forget about are there's some hospitals, there's some in Tampa, St. Pete, that have ventilator dependent patients already that are, you know, long term and they're on ventilators in these long term facilities, and the respiratory therapists there are working hard trying to get them off, and at the same time now they're going to have this issue to deal with. So it spreads farther than just in the hospitals.
And Dave, you've mentioned that you were in the ER once in Georgia or Atlanta where there was a mass shooting. Did you ever have that feeling or watch a doctor that had to make those kind of decisions about who got what resources, or was there enough to help all those people?
Well, I mean, obviously we were well equipped, but I mean, you have to call it at some point. I mean, you know, I've seen a lot of people die from gunshots and et cetera. I mean, but not as a result of a lack of, you know, access to you know, resources. That I've never really seen this before. I mean, we always had what we needed. It was just a question of whether or not, you know, we could, that person was going to make it. I mean, that's the essence of triage.
Okay. And I want to segue into sort of what we're dealing with on a daily basis in our regular lives, you know, our non-healthcare professionals as well as healthcare professionals. But Rick, as far as your old profession, is there anything you want to make sure we bring out to the audience, things that they may not be hearing other places, but, you know, you'd be able to tell them about?
Well, first of all, the respiratory therapists are pretty much, they're finally talked about on TV. You know, we're kind of the unsung people in the hospital, and most people that didn't know these folks that I've been able to work with and actually teach in some situations, that, you know, we've been doing this for years, and people never knew what we were doing. And now it's kind of coming to the forefront, the importance of these guys and gals out there doing their job. And so it's scary times for them. I've talked to a lot of my friends that are out there still working, and, you know, they're running out of equipment. They're running out of stuff already in this area. And it's hard on them because, like Dave said, we're there to save people. That's what we're expected to do. And it's never easy to not be able to do that. And we need to do something about getting the equipment to these people so we can get this taken care of.
Now, are you still licensed or certified where you could step up if you got the call?
No, I let my license go, and it's stuck in my head, but I'm not doing anything with it other than talking to you and talking to my friends about it.
All right. And so that gets us into the moment we're in right now, and we can talk about testing and the whys and wherefores of why these decisions are made. But let me just talk at the surface level first. You know, actually, here in Florida, Governor DeSantis is getting a lot of criticism for not being as strict as California or New York or some of the other states. I've got a lot of thoughts about that myself, but let's... Dave, you talked next to last, so you go first this time. What are your thoughts about the current level of precautions for Florida?
I think we have failed miserably nationwide. And again, I point back to the South Korean model, the way that they've responded. Short of testing at the level that they were successful at, then, you know, the social distancing and you know, keeping yourself inside is the only response that we can do right now. Now, I know that has a much more profound effect on our economy. But until we get the testing in place, now, and keep in mind, even though South Korea has been looser about allowing people out, it's because those people tested negative. The people that are testing positive are being removed from society, okay, and they're getting treatment, you know, as necessary. And so they've been very aggressive in there in that, you know, mode. So and we need to follow that same sort of pathway, in my opinion.
In our here and now, right now, do you think Governor DeSantis needs to elevate this to a complete stay-at-home order?
Absolutely.
Okay. Rick, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know about that. That's going to be tough to do. I mean, you can see what's happening now. The beach is supposedly closed, and, you know, you're supposed to be keeping a distance, but you can see that people, there's just going to be people that aren't going to listen, unfortunately. So, you know, I'd hate to see it come to that, but I think people should just do it voluntarily. You know, why do you need somebody to tell you to do that in this situation? Why can't you just do it yourself and, you know, think of others and understand that it, you know, yeah, you might not get it, but you might have it, not know it, or it might pass on to somebody else that you love, and, you know, that would be horrible.
I do want to say, normally during this show, because of the nature of its normal topics, we don't take phone calls, but if somebody's listening and they have a question or a comment about the situation, we do have one open phone line at 941-745-1490. 941-745-1490. Again, if you want to call, 941-745-1490. You know, one of the things that Governor DeSantis, and, you know, especially Dave and I, well, I know Rick's sort of political too. We're always looking at the subtext of why people do stuff. And, you know, on one hand, I agree with what Governor DeSantis is doing, but I can't do it. I can't have an opinion from a healthcare professional standpoint. I'm just an observer. But the other part of me observing is it would be very easy for him just to go along and, you know, not have to have this criticism, not have to deal with the heat politically, but just because he's now got the cover of what 8 or 9 other governors have done this. It's not going to be like, oh, he's getting out off the reservation, he's going crazy. But on the other hand, he says that he's worried about the mental health of the people in the state. We already have the stay-at-home order in Broward and Dade. He's worried about the compliance level that, you know, if you're asking for that kind of compliance now, if it need to take it up a notch in a couple weeks, you're going to start to get noncompliance a lot sooner than if you just wait a little bit longer. Any thoughts from either of you on that idea? Oh, and let's also point out that for all this stay at home and be safe, a lot of abused spouses are staying at home with an abusive partner, and the families that are in stress are being stressed out even more under these conditions. Go ahead.
Well, with all respect to Rick's opinion, he shared, you know, the problem is that, look, it only takes, you know, 20% of the people not to follow instruction. Americans, and I don't mean this to be, you know, racist or anything like that. Asians tend to be more obedient in terms of, you know, the way that they're raised. It's a very cultural difference. And we have this individual freedom mentality that, you know, don't tread on me kind of mentality. And some people actually go out just to respond to that, you know, this order, you know, that you can't go out, you know, and they say, the hell, you can't stop me, you know, and that's sort of a sense of community freedom and individual freedom, and the individual freedom is totally reliant upon the sense of community freedom. That's why we're a nation of laws, you know, that's why we don't, you know, do things to each other without.
Okay, we get your point. Let me take you up on this a little bit, because I can't go into a restaurant. Lots of stores are closed. Most businesses I can't go into, and I need to stay off the beach because people abuse that. But, you know, there's a park right around the corner from the station that's acres and acres. I could be the only person in 50 feet around me. You know, what difference does it make if I'm out there, I drive in my sealed-up car, I get out in the parking lot, and I walk around the trees and stuff just to get out of the house for a little bit? What's wrong with that?
I don't have a problem with it.
Go ahead, Rick.
Have to use common sense, and then I guess some of that is lacking these days. You know, you should be able to go out and you know, this social distancing thing is, you know, use your heads, you know, and
is this Rick or Dave?
This is Rick.
Oh, okay. I was thinking you were sounding too sensible there.
I know, it's scary, isn't it? But, you know, you got to use your head. And, you know, but there's a lot of people, you know, just like we had here out in Lombo Pass this weekend. There's pictures circulating of all these people out in their boats, you know, and I've heard different stories. It's the angle of the shot. That's why it looks like they're so close. And then there's, you know, oh, they were all staying a safe distance from each other. But, it, you know, I agree with Dave. There's always going to be those people that want to, you know, just push it. We've got to push the limit to see how far we can go and how far it'll get away with.
Okay, so let me not take a full time out here, but just let me take a pause, because Dave is reliving past glory here on 1490 AM, so he's good being here till the top of the hour. Rick, I'm afraid that I'd love you to stay to the top of the hour, but I know you're so concerned about saying controversial statements that yeah. I don't want to put you in a bad spot.
No, I'm all right. I'm actually having fun.
Okay,
so
all right.
If you hang around, I will. If not, then I will.
Okay, I don't think anybody's unfriended you on Facebook in the last 40 minutes yet.
I don't know yet. I haven't been on there, but I'll check. There's
yeah, I don't think this is your typical level of unfriendliness, Facebook-wise. All right,
yes.
So let me bring in a couple stories here, and just so you have a heads up where I'm going with this, I want to talk about the testing and maybe a different approach to testing. And then not just the personal cost of you don't get to go to the park, but we're going to look maybe a little deeper into the societal costs and the national costs. All right, so we talked about the FDA approval for the 45-minute test there from Cepheid or Cepheid's. Expert Express is going to be 23,000 systems worldwide that can be doing the testing, and that's one way to ramp up. That's already got FDA approval. Have another test from that Scanwell here in the U.S. is trying to get FDA approval, smartphone-based. It's been used, according to this article, by millions in China, and we'll see if that comes forward. That would make it a lot easier for many people. Once the test is available, people deemed eligible via Scanwell screening process and their Scanwell Health app will be sent the test via next-day delivery. They'll be guided by telehealth partner Lemonade, yes, I pronounced that correctly, licensed doctors and nurse practitioners. They'll then receive results and further guidance about those results via the app within a few hours. The whole testing process will cost $70, and Scanwell says that just covers its cost, and I'll put in my little parentheses, at their current scale, I don't know what it costs them once they go into the millions in the U.S. production. But, you know, let's not look a gift horse in the mouth, I guess. But now this third story is another way of looking at this. Now, I spent a lot of time watching CNBC, and anybody that listens to the show before that I produce Talking Markets knows that that's like part of the requirements. And there was this one fund manager that seemed very acute in his knowledge and very specific in how he was analyzing the situation. And one of these things he said like two or three days ago on the air was, you know, we need to start testing for antibodies. We're not just go with a positive test case for COVID-19. If we were testing for antibodies, then we could be finding people that maybe had already had the COVID-19, had recovered, they wouldn't be active cases, they wouldn't show up in the way we're testing now, but we would see the antibodies and we would know they're relatively safe compared to the rest of the population. They could be at work, they could be productive. Now, one of the things that we're looking at is just what the cost to our economy and society is. Explain to the audience a little bit better than I did, or a lot better than I did, about antibody tests and why that could be an important way of approaching this. Dave, you want to take that one?
Please. Well, sure. I mean, I'm, you know, all of us in healthcare, providers, caregivers, all, you know, given Hep B shots early in our career before we can ever take the floor. And they check those titers periodically to make sure that you still have the antibodies, because you will have built up immunity to hepatitis B. So throughout your career, you need to get blood tests, and they can measure whether or not there's sufficient antibodies, and it has to reach a certain level of antibodies. You may still have some presence of antibodies, but not at the level it's necessary to ward off the disease should you come in contact with it. So that's, it's pretty simple. I mean, the doctor's absolutely correct.
All right, and I think we're nationally, our testing has gone to, I think, confirmed over 40,000 confirmed cases. I think we're around 42,000. If I'm trying to look it up right now, because it changes by the hour here, it seems like, which is still, that's a tiny fraction of the population of the U.S. But that's all we've been able to test. We've tested 40,000, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand more maybe. I don't even think the number's that high. I think I'm overestimating. Even that's such a tiny bit of the population because of the complexity and the cost of the test. But
I heard, I'm sorry, Henry.
Go ahead.
I heard today that the University of Florida is actually doing some of the testing now, because I guess most of it was supposed to be sent to the CDC or certain labs, but now the University of Florida has taken on a lot of the testing themselves, too, to try to speed things up.
Well, and we're supposed to also have LabCorp and Quest Diagnostics are supposed to be rolling out, and we're going to try and aggregate all this. But even
let me jump in there, Henry, because, yeah. I mean, 42,000 is of course, a joke. Those are just confirmed positive cases. I mean, you can probably easily multiply that times 10. And this goes back to basically this epidemiology 101. I mean, these are droplet transmitted largely. It's not aerosol, which the difference between aerosol and droplet is pretty significant. Aerosol is much more easily transmitted because it's a lighter molecule. It stays in the air longer. That's why they talk about the six-foot social distancing, because the droplets are heavier molecules. They will fall, and you don't run as much risk as for inhaling it. But nevertheless, everything has shown in all the countries that, China, South Korea, over in Hong Kong, Taiwan, that these things are cluster transmitted. It's close, contact. So it's mostly family members to family members. South Korea traced back their first cases to a church, and they were able to do it. Again, Epidemiology 101 started tracking all those people down and everybody that they had come into contact with after that. So that's why the isolation and the social contact, our social distancing, is so critical, particularly until we can start doing the testing, both for antibodies for those who have built up immunity and are safe, relatively safe, as you said, and those who are positive and aren't yet showing symptoms, and we can get those people in a quarantine situation and find out who they came into contact with and get those people in absolute isolation, no questions asked. If they want to argue about it, they can go to jail. That's the level I'm at, because that's the only way to get a handle on.
All right. As I'm double-checking my numbers, we're at 41,700 cases, confirmed cases in the U.S., and the global number is 372,000 plus. The mortality rate for the confirmed cases, it varies from country to country, but what initially seemed like 3% mortality rate, as more and more people test, seems to be approaching 1%. But again, the people that had mild cases aren't going into the mix. And one of the things that I guess in the next 10 minutes or so we could look at is whether or not the spread is really as the transmission rate is not necessarily accelerating now, just the testing is accelerating. Is that an incorrect statement or a fair statement?
I think it's an unknown statement.
Well, the testing is definitely accelerating. We do know that.
I mean, we simply don't know the answer to that. And I mean, are we Italy or are we South Korea? Again, Italy, their response was similar to what we did early on. So are our cases, much, much higher? Keep in mind that, some people will remain asymptomatic. Initially, people show, simple cold symptoms, and that's when it's at its most transmittable, is that early, you know, portion of the disease state. And so they're still just thinking they got a cold and coming into contact with people. People in their family, those people in the family get it, and they go outside because they're not feeling the cold symptoms. That's how this all, you know, gets spread. I mean, it's this thought that somehow, I mean, we have very open borders. We're not an island like Taiwan or Hong Kong.
Right. So do you think that the danger is, well, there's a definite danger of overwhelming the healthcare system. That's a real danger.
It was already occurring in some places.
Right. But that's a definite.
Uh-huh.
But have you seen evidence, you know, just from your observations of news, you just have access, you don't have any private information, but that the seriousness of the spread has, maybe you have a better term for, what I'm saying is we might have a lot of transmission that nobody is aware of, going to Dave's point about the testing. We do know there's a very finite number of ICU beds, a finite amount of equipment. We know once they get into the ventilators, then you have a high mortality rate.
Right.
But do you see it as something that the people that let me start again. I see a lot of hysteria. I see a lot of people that are very scared. Do you see that? And do you? What is your level of concern?
Well, I don't see a whole lot. Especially I'm living on the island, so I don't see a whole lot of people that are scared. There's, you know, you have your scattering of people, but you know, if people are just aware of how it's transmitted and understand that it's fairly easy to, you know, keep it from carrying on by doing the simple things of 6 feet and, you know, and being who you, you know, careful about who you're around, and you know, you know, those are the important things. And like I said, you know, we got to be careful too, not just the hospitals, but these long-term facilities that these people are in. You know, those are, you know, dangerous too, and because they're certainly more susceptible to everybody else than anybody else. So the, you know, there's certainly a big concern, and there are a lot
opinion,
of people out here that are concerned.
We'll get there.
Overreacting. I think we're
wait a minute. You're both talking to time. Let Rick finish, and then I'll go.
Is the media squeezing every nickel out of this thing they possibly can? Absolutely. I mean,
yep.
You know, it's 24/7, and okay. You know, obviously that gets tiresome and wears you down, and you put on Netflix, but.
Okay.
I think we've underreacted from a response if we're serious about getting our economy back in shape sooner than later and limiting the number of deaths.
Okay. All right. We need to sort of move into a different phase of this now.
Shore-to-shore issue, yes.
Okay.
Obviously, the flyover.
Well, let me speak to that and take it into the last thing that I want to discuss.
Even though there are cases
to discuss
in all 50 states.
Okay.
Dave,
we're going to run out of time.
It is hard as the coastal.
You got to stop.
Population. So this is our opportunity.
Dave, you spent too much time listening to yourself. Hold on. We were going to give you more time, but I got to get into this next point before we sign off. All right. So I sent both of you. I know Dave has read it. I don't know if you saw, Rick, the real long article about that was on Medium.com. It was on 2 days ago. I sent it to a bunch of my family and friends.
Uh-huh.
When I saw it, that by the 24 hours later, Medium.com had pulled it down for violation of their policies, which is like when Facebook says, oh, you can't talk about that stuff, or Twitter says that, or Google or any of the big tech companies say, oh, you know, that's not allowed to be discussed on this platform.
Right.
Yeah, but there was a vague violation they didn't specify. But 2.8 million people viewed this article. It got a lot of circulation in social media before it got pulled. One of the things, let me say, Rick, did you get a chance to look that over?
I looked over it. Yeah, that was the long one that had all the stats and a lot.
Right. And one of the things that it was showing was, There was one really telling chart that had confirmed cases and recovered cases. So the bottom, like if you picture a triangle that's starting to go parabolic, the bottom half was recovered cases. The top line, about twice as high, was the confirmed cases. So in other words, 50% of the confirmed cases had seemed to be recovered or thereabouts. And then the death rate, or the number of deaths, not the death rate, the quantity of death was then a number that was laid on top from the beginning to the current. And that, at the beginning, the number of deaths relative to confirmed cases and recovered cases was a pretty big proportion of the vertical vertical line. But then as you get up to the top, the number of deaths have not increased at the same rate as the confirmed cases, which indicates, you know, we got a lot more testing on, so we got a lot more confirmed cases. So deaths are becoming a smaller portion of that. And again, I say this, it is very easy, you know, when you're talking about how ICU's beds of 8 to 12 per hospital, it's really easy to overwhelm the system, and then it's really easy to get people on ventilators, and the mortality rate goes high. So it's a serious threat. But it could be a very big exposure to the general population that we don't even know about, which takes us back to the testing we were talking about. So that gets us – I also sent this article to a former head of a hospital. And he also said this is important data to look at, that it coincided with some of his observations. I don't want to overstate his opinion, even though I'm leaving him anonymous right now. So it is within the possibility that I'm submitting to you two that we could have a lot of deaths. It could be very serious for people that ever get to the ICU. But it may not be to the level that the media and some individuals are worried about. Is that at least a fair statement? It may not be true, but is it a fair statement to put out?
I think that's a fair statement as far as I'm concerned, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, they're gonna stir up the fear as much as they can, you know. And,
all right. So right now we're looking, let's say we have a 1% death rate on confirmed cases. We have 41,000 in the U.S. If it were to stay like that, you know, we could say, you know, 420 of those people are likely to pass. And, you know, maybe the rate this is increasing with confirmed cases, maybe we get to 400,000 confirmed cases. And then you're looking at 4,000 people that could pass. And you can go up from there by a factor of 10 each time, and the numbers can get high fast. But when you look at what we've done to the economy, shutting down the entire country, and we're now estimating that this week's unemployment will have 3 million new unemployment claims, that we're going to exceed 20% unemployment. We're going to go to Great Depression levels, but Great Depression when people could go back live on the farm.
Right.
And our gross domestic product is going to go down by, I think it was Goldman Sachs, estimated close to 30%. Others are estimating 20 to 24%. If we had an external enemy that was trying to attack our society and do that much damage to it, we'd consider it an act of war. And if we were in that mindset, and of course a lot of the political personalities are trying to cast themselves as wartime leaders or taking us to war against a virus, et cetera, we would be willing to – we would take those sacrifices. We give up 4,000 dead. We give up – you know, this is – I hate to be so cold about it, but it seems like the casualties we would accept if we could pin this on an external enemy would be totally acceptable to this country.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
And yet we're risking something that we could have chaos in the streets. I mean, you couldn't police our big urban centers with the kind of law enforcement we have with the National Guard. You know, we really risk a lot of breakdown of our normal life over this. Now, now with our 4 minutes left, what are your thoughts? Let's start with Rick.
Well, I do think it puts us in a really bad place, you know, but I think that people should calm down, just take care of themselves, stay out of these social areas, you know, and try to, you know, police themselves and wash your hands. Wash your hands a lot, you know, and just take care of each other as far as the best you can.
Are you looking for a data point or a situation that you would think, oh, we're past the peak, less danger?
Well, they're saying, you know, that it's, you know, eventually all viruses and stuff, they have their peak, and then they kind of fizzle out, and that's what they're kind of waiting for now. And you know, and if it gets hotter and more humid outside down here, it's supposed to help, you know, with that situation. So it's kind of, we're sailing in uncharted waters.
All right. Dave?
Well, I mean, just a quick response to Rick on that. We don't have any data on this particular virus that humidity or climate has any effect on at this juncture. So we can't rely on that, obviously, and I'm not saying you were insinuating that.
No.
Yeah, I think this just goes back to leadership and response. I mean, did we have to get to this point if we had had you know, potentially the pandemic response team still a part of the National Security Council? Had our leadership listened to the voices that were speaking in the ears? That, you know, let's get on top of this early. I think we could have avoided a lot of this. I think that your article here that you've shared and I've read, is it completely accurate? Well, there's no way to know. This individual doesn't know, but makes some great points to the effect that people that, one, are either now have been infected and have antibodies, or two, test negative, can get back to work. I think that would be vital to the nation, the well-being of the country, from a mental health standpoint, from obviously an economic standpoint. But leadership, I mean, this is a national problem. It's not a state problem. You know, when I crossed the line at 75 at Georgia, you know, it doesn't stop. This is a national issue. It's an international issue, obviously, but it's up to our leaders in D.C. to handle this and come up with a coherent, executable plan, and they have failed miserably.
All right, that's going to be the last word. Rick, I want to thank you so much for making time, especially on such very short notice. And Dave, like old times here today, only you're somewhere else.
I usually was then.
Yeah. Thank you both, and we'll talk off the air sometime later. Thanks.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you, Henry.
I want to thank again Dave and Rick for being there. And also, the article that we described, as I said, it got taken down. I may try and paste it as in its entirety on Facebook for the Henry Raine Show page, and maybe Facebook will allow me to do that. If it does, I will certainly check the Henry Raine Show Facebook page, but I will let you know in next week if we aren't banned from the studio by a governor's edict. You've been listening to The Henry Raine Show.